They will not even come, because our submarines will sink them. America, from a military point of view, means nothing. And again, nothing. And for a third time, nothing.
Coming up, an unprepared America enters the war, losing its innocence, but gaining a world-class army. This is the story of World War I as remembered by its last eyewitnesses.
The war was on in Europe. Germany was knocking the heck out of everything.
When we went into the war, why, it was quite a popular thing for a young man to do.
I said, what the hell? Look at all these guys, 18, 19, 20, 21. I'm going to join the army.
Of course, the old veterans keep dying off, and the young people are coming up, and they haven't gone through that, so they don't know.
They were coming fast and furious. Bombs are falling everywhere.
In 1917, the United States committed itself to the Allied cause in Europe. It was a decision reached at first reluctantly, and then with outrage when Germany threatened both the country's maritime commerce and the security of its border with Mexico. The future Republican President Warren G. Harding was no great fan of the Wilson administration, but for a moment party lines had blurred as America rolled out its first military operation over there.
Over there!
The Republic must awaken. The people must understand. The fate of the nation and the safety of the world will be decided on the western battlefront of Europe. Primarily, the American Republic has entered the war in defense of its national rights. A republic worth living in is worth fighting for and sacrificing for and dying for.
We're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there.
No military had ever set out on such a high-minded course with such limited resources. At the time, the U.S. Army numbered only 108,000, ranking 17th in the world. The Marine Corps numbered only 15,000, and these troops were already deployed in other parts of the globe. President Wilson had hoped that the American commitment would be one of supplies and materiel, but from the Allies came the cry, "We need men." Limited conscription had taken place during the Civil War, but for the first time in May 1917, Wilson signed a law requiring men aged 21 to 29 to register for the draft. The age would later be extended to ages 18 to 35. Many would never receive the call. But when it came, usually in the form of a telegram, it often gave only a few days' notice. George Johnson, at 112 years old, is the oldest man in California. He was living in Philadelphia in 1917 when his number came up.
He saw this note under the door. Father picked it up and looked at it. It was a letter from the government, from a draft voter, for me to report 6 o'clock in the morning. That was the next morning. I said, look, I said, I've got this letter, and I showed you the letter. Yeah, that's for you. Come on, get on the train. I said, look, I have to go home and get some clothes. You don't need any clothes. We got plenty of clothes where you're going.
Between 1917 and 1918, some 24 million men would fill out the lengthy application form required at the time. This form, which went into great detail about the applicant's family background, health, and economic status, would provide future historians with a valuable demographic profile of the wartime generation. General Stephen Burkheiser.
The fact is, draft registration today is quite simple. It's just a postcard. But in 1917, when the U.S. instituted the draft registration form was 12 pages long.
As in future wars, draftees had no say in where they would be sent. Because of this, many chose to enlist, including 109-year-old Ernest Pusey.
I enlisted when I was 21. I enlisted in the Navy because I didn't want to be in the trenches. If you're in the Navy, you're out of the trenches.
Lloyd Brown, a 105-year-old veteran living outside Bethesda, Maryland, also chose to enlist in the Navy, though for different reasons.
I was 16, but I told him I was 18. I was 2 years younger than my record shows. He sent me to Great Lakes, Illinois for a little basic training, maybe 30 days. Then they put me on a battleship, New Hampshire. One of my ship's duties was to look for submarines. That was our job. Most all the young people were doing it at that time. When we went into the war, why, it was quite a popular thing for a young man to do, is to enlist during the war. That's why I went in, because a lot of other young people like myself were going in. Very popular among the young ladies, too, and I wasn't following the war very much.
But not all enlistees were sent overseas. With the Zimmerman telegram and the possibility of a war with Germany along America's southern border, cavalry soldiers were needed along the border from Texas to the Pacific coast. Like many recruits, Samuel Goldberg was looking for adventure. At 106, Rhode Island's oldest veteran recalls how his choice ultimately went with the cavalry.
I said, what the hell? Look at all these guys, 18, 19, 20, 21. I'm going to join the Army. And I went to the recruiting office. I understood that they can use, Signal Corps. There was such a place known as Signal Corps. That's a dangerous spot. You're up there giving signals and they shoot at you. It occurred to me, here was the dangerous part of being the soldier. That's for me. So I go downtown and I say, I want to join the Army and I want to join the Signal Corps. And the recruiting sergeant, pretty smart guy, he said, nah, join the cavalry. Cavalry? Horses? Hey, wait a minute, I have no experience with horses. But what happened here was they were told, get cavalry recruits, we need them badly. So I said, okay, if that's what you want.
1 year before America's entry into global war, the first foreign attack had taken place on U.S. soil. After a failed bid for the Mexican presidency, a bandit and revolutionary named Pancho Villa, hoping to provoke the U.S. into a war with Mexico, raided the small border town of Columbus, New Mexico, killing 11 and leaving the town in ruins. In response, President Wilson deployed 15,000 cavalry troops to the border and sent a punitive expedition into Mexico. The expedition was led by Brigadier General John J. Pershing. Dr. Anthony Knopp is Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
When Pershing took his expedition into Mexico, there was great concern along the border about possible retaliation on the part of some Mexican entity or other. And then the Zimmerman telegram, when that became public, when Wilson made that public, then of course that caused an even greater panic, because the reward for Mexico joining in on the side of Germany, should the United States get into the First World War, was the lost provinces of Mexico, which included Texas.
Whether the Mexican government ever seriously considered Germany's offer is still a subject of debate. Dr. William Adams.
Had the Germans appeared closer to victory than they did at that moment, the Mexicans might have given that some thought. It wasn't certain who was going to win the war in 1917. And, of course, the consequences for the Mexicans to act on that telegram, actually engage the U.S., and then have the Allies victorious, it would have been disastrous for Mexico.
Samuel Goldberg was posted to the border fort at Hachita, New Mexico.
It's exactly 50 miles west of Columbus, where Pancho Villa shot up the station. This is 1916, in June. He came into midnight into Columbus and shot up the works and killed some people. After that, he was known as Villa the Bandit. There was definite enmity between Mexico and the U.S., especially the Pancho Villa thing. After the raid on Columbus, General Pershing, he was then a brigadier, he had a party of cavalry, and he went after Villa in Mexico. He spent, I don't know whether he spent a week there or a month or 2 months there. He'd never find Villa in Mexico, not among the hills of Mexico. That's when we first heard of Pershing.
Pershing's mission never encountered Pancho Villa. But Villa had achieved his goal of arousing the U.S. military into action, which would provide a training ground for the larger events which were about to unfold. Along the way, a general of no particular prestige had become a public figure, a symbol of the American fighting spirit. The following year, General Pershing would command the American Expeditionary Force in Europe.
A as the great army of American boys is streaming across the sea and taking its place beside the British and the French, I saw the heroic associates with whom our own army is to fight. And I had then, as I have now, a sense of stirring and rising pride in the feeling that America's great and splendidly equipped and prepared army is composed of men worthy to be classed with those heroes, and that they will find heroes worthy of their fellowship.
So spoke U.S. Secretary of War Newton Baker in 1917. But the U.S. Army was anything but prepared. In numbers, it ranked just behind Portugal. An aggressive enlistment campaign and a federal draft would soon increase its number of active duty soldiers to more than 4.5 million. Those who couldn't serve in the military were encouraged to support the war effort through massive fundraising drives. Oil tycoon and philanthropist John D. Rockefeller.
Do you want to see the flower of the manhood of this country, which has brought everlasting glory to our nation, neglected in the hour of its greatest need? I confidently believe that the American people will stand solidly behind the men in uniform, and that they will regard it a privilege to contribute to the limit.
General Pershing sent his own rallying cry from the battlefields of France in this rare wax recording.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake. Only the hardest blows can win against the enemy we are fighting. Invoking the spirit of our forefathers, the Army asks your unflinching support to the end that the high ideals for which America stands may endure upon the earth.
Support for those high ideals ran strong, and the recruitment rolls soon swelled. Those who were not yet old enough to enlist found creative ways of beating the system. Among the World War I veterans living today are a number of these underage soldiers, like John Babcock, an American citizen who joined the Canadian Army when he was only 15 and a half.
The Canadians were hard up for men. They didn't have conscription. Of course, a lot of young men were reluctant to sign up and go to war. Of course, at the age that I didn't know any better, and I was 15 and a half years old, and I was a good-sized kid, and they asked me if I'd like to, and I said yes. So I signed up, and I got a physical, and I was physically fit, but I was underage, so my category was A4. Well, for some reason or other, my name wasn't called by the people that were turned down. So I put my pack on and got on the train, and we got to England, and they rounded up all the kids in the Canadian Army that were underage. There were 1,300 of us, and they sent us to Bexhill-on-Sea, that's in Sussex, and they called us the Young Soldiers Battalion.
We know you love your land of liberty. We know you love your USA. But if you want the world to know...
The popular music of the time acted as a rallying cry, encouraging young men to do their part for Uncle Sam in the war effort, as in this song, For Your Country and My Country, by the Peerless Quartet.
It's your country, it's my country, with millions of real fighting men. And it is your duty and my duty to speak with the sword, not the pen.
At the start of the war, only men over 21 years of age were drafted. But enlistments in the Army were accepted as young as 18, the route chosen by 107-year-old Homer Anderson.
I was pretty young. I was too young to be drafted. So I decided what I'd do is enlist, and I did.
At 108, Howard Ramsey of Portland, Oregon, is one of only three living U.S. veterans to have seen action in the trenches in France. Like many aspiring soldiers, he joined up with a friend.
I went up to enlist. My buddy and I, we were too young, you know. No, we were too underweight, that was it. We was underweight. So we went out and ate a lot of bananas and went back and we passed. I don't think we'd had our 18th birthday.
The youngest American World War I veteran, Frank Buckles, is 105. After lying about his age to get into the Marines and then the Army, he finally settled on the ambulance corps.
I went to the recruiting station for the Marine Corps. The nice sergeant told me that I just wasn't old enough. I had to be 21. So I'll try elsewhere. I went to Oklahoma City. There, they asked for my birth certificate. I explained that when I was born in Missouri, there were no public records. It was in the family Bible. They took me at that and sent me out to Fort Logan, Colorado, to enlist in the regular army. The sergeant there said, if you want to get to France in a hurry, join the ambulance corps, because the French are asking for ambulance service. I did, and they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas, where I had training in trench retrieval and for French ambulance service.
He was stationed at Winchester, England, which for the ambitious 16-year-old ambulance driver was not enough. France, of course, was where the action was and where he wanted to be.
As much as I liked England, I wanted to get on to France. I appealed to everybody. Oh, I was here working every scheme I could.
And yet, with carnage reaching sometimes unimaginable dimensions along the Western Front, the U.S. media was often hesitant to portray the true nature of the suffering. Soldiers training for combat often had little idea of what lay ahead. George Johnson.
You didn't even know what was going on, you know what I mean, in the war. They never told you anything at all about, never heard no newspapers, no nothing. Didn't tell you a thing about war. I guess they just didn't want us to know about it, you know what I mean? They didn't want us to know about what was going on.
John Babcock recalls an aspect of the new warfare that had become a common part of every soldier's training, chemical warfare.
We had to go through the gas chamber. They give us gas masks, and the skirt of the mask would be under the collar of your coat, and you'd button it up around it. We actually went through where there was gas, lethal gas, but you had that gas mask on. We had a captain, and he had been gassed. It affected his speech. He couldn't give a loud command.
Howard Ramsey.
It was a court-martial offense. You'd caught without a gas mask. So we were under that threat all day and night. As I remember, smelling mustard. I think we called it a mustard gas, if I remember right.
J. Russell Coffey, who turned 108 in September 2006, was another enlistee eager to see action in France.
I had two brothers, or I'd have been over in the front line. They were trying to keep me out of it. My older brother was out on the Western Front, but my other brother got sick on his way over, and after he got to France, they sent him home. Just like everybody else, the boys were going. I wanted to go too.
American infantrymen had been fondly called doughboys since the time of the Civil War, though the origins of the term are shrouded. Some say it refers to the dough-like adobe buildings that often housed Army soldiers at remote outposts in the 19th century. Others, that it refers to the dough-like globular buttons on early uniforms. Whatever the origins, by the 4th of July 1917, General Pershing was marching his first unit of AEF doughboys down the Champs-Élysées in Paris. By the year's end, 10,000 robust American servicemen were arriving in Europe each day. Dr. William Adams.
It was enough to tip the balance very quickly towards the Allied side. Not only was it the numbers of troops that we sent, but they came in with strong morale, fresh troops when the French and British soldiers had been ground down by this for many years.
General Pershing would not let his men be drawn into Allied skirmishes. Resisting the call by France and Great Britain to join the Allies, he made it clear that American soldiers would not simply fill gaps left in the Allied lines. The American Expeditionary Force would be an independent fighting unit, operating on its own terms and with its own tactics. His maverick attitude caused the Allied commanders to bristle at what they perceived as American arrogance. And yet, his approach would set a pattern for America's involvement in another European war, 2.5 decades later. 3.5 years of trench fighting had reduced much of Belgium and France into a stew of mud and barbed wire and human carnage. 110-year-old Tony Piero was an Italian immigrant who saw enlistment as a chance for quick American citizenship. He saw action in the Battle of St. Mihiel and the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, two battles in which U.S. participation proved decisive in pushing back the German line and rebuilding morale among the Allied troops. The fighting in the Argonne Forest was particularly brutal, with American mortality during the first 3 weeks of fighting running an average of 1,000 lives a day. 90 years later, Piero's eyes still mist over when he recalls those 3 deadly weeks.
I wasn't afraid to get killed. I'd go through anything. But I came back. I came out alive and well. A lot of the fellows, they lost an arm, a leg, they went blind. A lot of them fellows, too bad. I want to forget all those bad days. You think the next minute your life is over. Every day, life, it was there to get killed. Thank God I come out alive. Many of my brothers, they kicked the bucket.
One of Howard Ramsey's fondest memories of France was when he was waiting outside his military vehicle to drive an officer somewhere, and a little French girl came by and sat in his car and asked him for a souvenir. He said he didn't have anything, but looked around and gave her an American penny, and she gave him a little gift wrapped in tissue. As she left, he looked in the tissue and found a lock of her curly hair. He still has that lock of hair, but he also carries with him memories of the trenches and the relentless shelling that characterized the latter part of the war.
Remember, we were back to the trenches, and we were shelled every night. And I remember one time, we were in a little town, and we couldn't go in it because they held us up. And the only place to sleep there was in the cemetery. I can remember sleeping in between there, but kept the wind off of it. And I don't know how many nights we slept there.
Ramsey was one of the few men who could drive, an unusual skill in 1917.
Nobody drove. We had to teach one of those guys how to drive. Those guys couldn't drive a nail. And we had to teach them how to drive, and we were under shell fire half the time, and it wasn't very pleasant, I'll tell you.
The lot of most American doughboys in Europe was to serve in the trenches, where the stakes grew higher, and the fighting became more and more desperate.
They were coming fast and furious. Bombs were falling everywhere. So you had a duck. It was just like a dream. I'm glad it was I'll never see it again.
The 3-week Meuse-Argonne offensive was a key battle for the United States and the Allies, coming at a time when the German resistance was breaking. The balance was already tipping in the favor of the Allies due to the fresh, energetic U.S. troops. But the Germans weren't yet willing to capitulate, responding with deadly shelling.
In order to escape a trap, I'd dress up like a civilian, and they wouldn't recognize me, like a spy, you know, get all the information you could get, different movements of the enemy. That's a dangerous job. I got away. I got out of the danger spot. A shell would come in and it'd kill half a dozen soldiers. A bunch of fellows would get killed, and they put another bunch. It just changed them over. It's no good. It's better to be at peace and have beer together.
The oldest living World War I veteran to have seen combat experience is also the oldest man living in the continental United States. Moses Hardy is 113 years old. As an African American, he served in a segregated unit, the 805th Pioneer Infantry. While he was unable to speak during his interview for this program, his son, Haywood Hardy, related a family legend handed down by his father about Army food on the combat lines.
Now, he used to tell us that he believed when he first got older, he was scared to death. But he said he thanked that they used to feed them something to make them brave. And after a while, they wasn't scared of nothing. Bullets just flying everywhere. You run, duck, but you wasn't scared. So it had to be something. You tell them about, you see old green water there, and you take your canteen and dip down in there, and then you had a pill to put in there to purify it. Shake it up good and drank it. Go right on. It didn't make you sick, that pill. He used to tell me, too, about lunches, hard tacks and stuff like that little packet of food, little box about that long, little flat. And you, when you eat that, whatever in that little box, you be full. It had it fully packed. Little can of ham, little can of chicken, hard tack bread, and about four cigarettes being there. Another little can of what you call pudding or pie. And when you eat all of it, you'll be full.
Moses Hardy entered the war in May 1918. After the armistice, the colored soldiers were among those who were kept behind to identify the dead and clean up the battlefields. Then, as now, returning veterans often had trouble shaking off their combat experience and the memories.
He was a pretty strong old man. Yeah. I know shortly after he come out of the war, he used to fall out, walk along and fall out, like faint. And then he'd lay there a while and get up and go ahead on. But as he got older, he didn't do that no more. He used to tell about so many of his buddies got killed all around him. But he survived. He believed in the Lord, so he said the Lord saved him, you know. I guess them fellas believed in him too, but they had to go.
You're listening to the World War I Living History Project.